Good morning, this is Ellis Conklin at KMUN Astoria, KTCB Tillamook, and streaming live at KMUN.org. The time is 9:30 a.m. on May 26th, 2026. So let's begin. With me in my studio today is Dardell Trowan.
Hi.
And Jeff Daly.
Morning to you.
And thank you very much for coming. We're going to talk about Molly's Room a lot today. We're going to talk about a program that they're also having called Entwined Legacy and Memories. So let's begin. Molly's Room. Your sister, Molly was taken away at 2 years old, right? Or 3 years old?
Just a week shy of her third birthday.
My gosh.
Yes.
And what happened? Just explain to the listeners what happened exactly.
Well, Molly was born here at Astoria. She was my sister. When she was born, there was some thought and some talk from the doctors that she was considered to have a disability. That disability was a lazy eye and a club foot. In today's times, I think that would not really be considered a disability, but back in the 1950s, that was considered to be an issue. She had a surgery done, which corrected the club foot. She had a surgery done on her lazy eye, which ended up blinding her. Shortly before, as I said, her third birthday, she was deemed to be considered extremely mentally retarded, and it was suggested by doctors and people that were professionals that she be sent to Fairview, to the Fairview Hospital, an institution which originally was called a home for the feeble-minded.
In Salem, Oregon.
Mm-hmm. So I was Molly's brother, 6 years old, and one morning I woke up, and Molly wasn't there. She was actually taken to Salem by my aunt and uncle, committed to an institution, and I was not told why she was gone or where she had gone, and I was also told that we would not talk about her anymore as she was no longer part of our family.
So your mother kept going on and on. She only visited one time, right?
That's what we were able to figure out. We went years later, we were able to see the records of Molly, and we determined that, yes, in all of the paperwork, we saw that she came down one time for a very short time to observe her, and then that was it.
Like Rose Kennedy, like Rosemary and Rosemary.
Very similar, yes.
And she had a lobotomy, right?
Yes.
Back in 1940s.
Yep.
Rose Kennedy only came to visit her one time in Wisconsin, right?
I believe so.
Yeah. So it was your father then that was ingenious, right? He came as a clown.
Well, yes. When Molly was sent to Salem, my dad would go down there twice a month on the weekends to go down and visit his daughter that was committed to this institution. After a month or two of him doing that, he was asked by the staff, by the Fairview people, to not continue to come back to visit his daughter because she found it so uncomfortable. She found it disruptive because she would cry uncontrollably whenever my dad would leave, which would be normal for any child, especially a child that was in an institution that had zero love, zero attention being placed upon them. And then to be visited by her father once every couple of weeks to be held, show some love and comfort. It was an important part of her life, but the staff determined that it couldn't be done anymore because it was disruptive to the other people, and they asked my dad to not come back, to not visit anymore at the hospital. So he came up with kind of an ingenious idea to be able to see his daughter under disguise, the disguise of a clown. My dad was one of the founders of the start of the Astoria Clowns. They formed in 1955. There was a dozen of these local businessmen that got together.
It's called the Astoria Clown Car.
The Astoria Clowns, yes, and they had a goal in mind. Their goal was to get the bridge built, the Megler Bridge. Being businessmen, they realized that if we had to build a bridge there, that we'd have people coming in from Washington. It would be traveling here to spend money, to promote our businesses, our community. So this was a group of businessmen, they realized that. Well, along with one of their other ideas was that when they would be out on parades, as they traveled across the state, they would always have an opportunity to swing by Salem at the institution, dressed as clowns, and they would go and they would visit the residents of Fairview Hospital. And of course, my sister's house was one of those spots that they would go. So they never knew when, on a Saturday or a Sunday, all of a sudden there'd be a dozen clowns showing up at Fairview Hospital. And the idea was that so my father could go in there and have an hour or two that he'd be able to spend with his daughter.
Now, Dardanelle, you're an activist, a designer, and an end-of-life doula.
Mm-hmm.
For my listeners, I think I believe I know what a doula is, and I know how the difference is between a doula and hospice care.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could tell us what a doula is exactly and how it differs from, or maybe it doesn't differ, but what are the differences between a doula and hospice care?
Well, a doula is, we support individuals at end of life, just like a birth doula would support a mother expecting life. But we are not, we're not nurses or medical doctors of any sort, but we're there to basically advocate for our clients and help them ensure that they have, that their end of life is as comfortable and shaped in the way that they'd like it to be. So whether that's helping them work on their legacy, helping them sit with and be present for what this transition brings, it can run a very wide range of activities.
So basically, in hospice care, you get the drugs, right?
Yeah.
With a doula, you're just with you. They're with you. A doula's with you 24 hours a day if you want it.
If you want it, yeah. They are, or coming to be with you for once a week, or, kind of doing research, helping you think about what you want your end of life to be, because we will come in and help people at any stage of life. They don't have to be actively dying. They can be just thinking about what the future and what their death might look like. And then we are basically advocating for them and helping them get the resources and the assistance that they may need in whatever that looks like.
What is social practice art exactly?
Well, social practice art is, it's kind of interesting. It's basically we're using public engagement as our medium, where an artist might work with watercolors or paint. Like, we are creating collaborative, participatory engagements. So around whatever a particular subject might be. So rather than, again, it's like our medium is working with the public. Our medium is working within spaces.
And how does Molly's Room tie into that?
Well, so I'm working with a group called Our Fairview, and Our Fairview is a 2-year social practice project that was conceived by two artists in Corvallis, Bruce Burris and Jill Baker. And they are creating this 2-year engagement around Fairview Training Center. It's been closed for 25 years, but the legacy is still with us. And so the intention is to basically create awareness and create some public engagements where we're not only preserving stories, but we're also, kind of imagining what the future might look like outside of Fairview. And it's also a opportunity to kind of heal some of the wounds that are still kind of with us as a legacy of, whether you were a resident at Fairview or a staff at Fairview. There's just a lot there that still needs to be healed.
How did you come up with the idea of Molly's Room?
Well, that's Jeff.
That's Jeff.
Well, Molly's Room, it's at the Astoria Armory. The way it came about was the Astoria Armory has been with us as a skating rink. It's been around for many years. It's kind of been going through a rejuvenation. We've been able to get brand new skates put in. We've added new sound systems, lighting systems. We're bringing the armory back. The armory is back to what it was when we were kids growing up here, what it would have been when Molly would have grown up here, which she would have had available to her as a skating rink. So being part of the skating rink, being aware of people with disabilities, I thought it was important that that we have a spot within the Armory where a family comes with a variety of kids. Not all kids are going to be top end, raring to go, wanting to skate like crazy, listening to loud music. There are going to be children that have other issues. And perhaps they need a quiet place to go to. So that's how Molly's Room came about, was a little room off to the side where families could gather, where a mom that was could go with a child that needed just a little more quiet time, a little bit, didn't want to be out skating, didn't want to be out singing and doing with the rest of the kids, but can go into a room, has a window, so they could able to still watch out and see the activities going on. But there will be some stimulus, some items in the room itself that will be able to keep the kids entertained. So it holds its idea, and it holds the spirit of truly being a community spot where all families and all people can go.
I should add now that Jeff Daly is an Astorian who designed the WonderKund Astoria experience with underground tours and the Astoria Sign Museum at the Astoria Armory. He's a filmmaker. His greatest achievement is the documentary that you did on Molly about your long-lost sister, who is a patient at Fairview Training Center back in Salem, back when they called it the home for the imbeciles.
Feeble-minded, yes.
Feeble-minded, yeah. Rather.
They were very proud of that description.
Why? Why do you think?
I don't know, but they had a gigantic brass plaque that stood on a building down there. That was the name of what it was going to be, is for the people of feeble minds.
When was the last time you saw Molly?
Well, Molly passed away actually 10 years after I had a chance to reunite with her. So she died back, in May of, 14 years ago or so.
What did she die of?
Just natural causes. Mm-hmm. People that lived in institutions, they had an institutional lifestyle, meaning it was rough. It was tough. They did not have a normal life like what we consider to do in terms of age expectancy. Mm-hmm. Many times people died in their 20s and their 30s or institutions. It was a rough, tough place to survive, to live, to try and live, to stay alive. Molly was fortunate. She made it up to just a few weeks before her 60th birthday.
So when was the last time you saw her the last time? What did you say to her?
I gave her peace. I sat with her as she died. Yeah.
She was where was she then?
In Hillsborough.
In a hospital?
Or? In a hospital. Yeah, I had. I visited her often because we lived here in Astoria. She was in Hillsborough in a group home. After Fairview shut down, residents were put out into group homes, and it just so happened that Molly was in a group home in Hillsborough. Mm-hmm. And that's where I ended up discovering her after 47 years. By accident, discovered that she was in a group home, literally living less than 100 miles from me, and I didn't know it all these years.
It was Christine Thompson, right? Or Chris Thompson? Or
that? Cindy Thompson, Cindy, yes. My wife at the time, and mm-hmm. She was the one that helped me get on track and discover and find that Molly was still there. And we discovered it after my parents had passed away. We actually found a little note in my dad's wallet saying Molly Daly with a social security number and an address. And that's how we were able to go, like, she's still around perhaps, because my dad was carrying her information in his wallet.
That's right. Yeah, I remember that now. And from your 10-minute, the documentary I saw on CVS that you did, right?
Yes.
You did that, 8 years ago?
Back in 95, I think it was 2005 is when we actually did the documentary.
Mm-hmm. A documentary, that got a lot of attention or what?
It did get a lot of attention. It had a world premiere at the Portland International Film Festival. We ran in a theater up there at Living Room Theaters for 2 months. We showed it here at the Liberty Theater in Astoria. Sold out crowd, 585 people on the worst rainstorm night you'd ever seen in your life. But they showed up to come watch the film.
Jordan, now what exactly is your role in Molly's Room and preparing for it?
Well, so myself and actually Marn Lucas, who's a Portland-based mm-hmm. artist, interdisciplinary artist, social practice artist, death doula, she was brought in by Bruce and Jill to basically create these engagements, public engagements, and it's, like I said, it's been a 2-year project. She brought me on to help her with some of our early engagements, and in the course of learning about Fairview and the project myself, I realized that there was this connection because I knew Jeff Daly and I knew Molly's story, and I realized how you know, important it was to kind of fold that story in with the work that the R. Fairview project was doing. So the first thing we did is I interviewed Jeff for the story archive that R. Fairview is creating to basically capture stories by residents and staff. I interviewed Jeff, and then that's when we kind of had this conversation about Molly's room was being done and being ready to open, and we decided that we wanted to support that effort by creating the R. Fairview engagement around the opening of Molly's room.
Now, Molly's room is a quiet environment, right? Very
yes, it
quiet.
Is. Yep. Just a little room that's got some beanbag pillows, some games, some books. It's just a place where a kid, a child, a parent can go, and they can just have their own space to them.
What would Molly have thought of her own room?
Oh, she would be in there causing trouble, I'm sure. She'd be whooping it up and hollering, having fun. Molly was not a shy person by any means. She took command of any room, of any consideration she was in. The thing that's so interesting about the Molly's room, and one of the concepts of that, and the concepts we had with holding this fair that we had at the Armory, mm-hmm. was that back in the 50s, families didn't have sources or have tools or the communication opportunities to be able to say, what do you do with your child who has whatever issue they may have? What do you think I should do? There was not, the kind of consideration did not exist, that kind of communication. Not like today where we have an internet. You can go and find out anything about anybody within seconds. The idea of the Molly's room is that we can bring families together, and perhaps they can just talk one-on-one, face-to-face, and be able to share information of what their child is doing. Perhaps learn ideas, learn examples of what they could do to make their life better. That's the whole concept of Molly's room, is to get people talking, bring folks together, and make it a comfortable spot for them.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think of this Molly's room?
Well, what I love is that the idea of a sensory room, the idea of a place that is responsive to individuals that have all kinds of neurodivergencies, you know, I love that. I love that, you know, especially with the way Molly's room is set up, it's still part of the action and the activity. And when you're watching the kids go around on the skating rink, it can get really overwhelming. And the idea that you don't have to be separate from that, but you can be in a place that's going to be responsive to your needs, I think is so valuable. And what I love about and why we wanted to do this event was that if some people who have no idea what a sensory room is get an awareness and a empathy for recognizing that everyone has different experiences of space and place, like, I feel like that's a big win, you know, mm-hmm. because we should have sensory rooms in all public places.
Really? You do? You think that?
I do. I mean, I was flying at the airport the other day, and the new one of the new wings has a beautiful sensory room in place. And it's beautiful and quiet and comfortable. And I went in and I kind of walked around and saw that there were people in there, and they were just really getting kind of that quiet moment away from the crazy din of the airport. And it's like, sometimes we just really need that. And people with different neurodivergencies need it even more. And we just, you know, and if they get that, you know, then they can self-regulate. Then they can, you know, they can take that moment and go out and re-engage.
Jeff, when we talk about Molly now, we're talking about a very serious problem in the 1950s. Now, in the 1990s, now that we're here now in the 2000s, now we have a whole different reality, right? What would you say that reality is right now?
And the reality is that it is reality, is that we are going into a different era, a different family structure with children and what's going on in our world with the influx of diseases, of mental issues that we haven't determined before, we haven't learned about before. You know, it used to be an occasional child was had a disability, whereas now it seems like it's the numbers are starting to get into the singles and double digits. It's frightening what's going on, meaning we have to be more aware of so many things that are going to be required for our communities, for our societies to be able to keep on going.
So what was Molly diagnosed with?
It was a lazy eye and a club foot.
That was it. So your mother decided basically that I think we need to, the doctor said you need to institutionalize her for that?
With some encouragement.
By?
Family members. She was considered to be not the perfect child because of these lazy eyes when she was blinded after a doctor blinded her with a surgery. She was not considered to be the perfect child. So with some family influence, it was encouraged that she be sent to Fairview. In our movie, we talked with professionals about this, and I never ran into a doctor yet that was able to say how some doctor could sit there and say that this child was severely mentally retarded and need to be institutionalized at the age of 2. I mean, it just wasn't possible at that time. She hadn't learned or had a chance to learn all of the different skills that she was going to learn. So how would you sit there and determine that at that time? Well, with encouragement, they were asked to do that.
Now, where's your brother now? Your older brother?
It's a younger brother.
Younger, yeah.
I don't know. I lost contact with him. When I did my documentary, my family, cousins and aunts and uncles and my brother, basically disowned me because they thought by telling the story about my sister, about Molly, about what happened with our family, they considered that to be an insult to the family name. So I was basically been blackballed from the rest of the family. So I don't know where they are.
Blackballed because you came out and said Molly is institutionalized.
Yeah. They didn't want the family name to be associated with a mentally retarded person.
My gosh.
It's like, I think that's in part why this project, this Our Fairview project, was conceived, is to, one, kind of undo that cultural perception of, you know, intolerance, or, you know, in the case of Molly, you know, like there's this shame or that just shouldn't be there. Like we should be celebrating our differences. We should be celebrating our neurodivergencies because they are contributing in beautiful ways, and that's also something that the Our Fairview project is capturing, is that it's, you know, that, you know, out of these neurodivergencies come some of the best imagination, some of the most amazing creations, and if we just shunter them away, we'll never have them.
What do you mean by neurodivergencies?
Well, you know, having just, you know, perceiving the world in a different way, perceiving the world, you know, whether you have a sensory issue, you know, we all kind of interact with the world differently. And for some people, that doesn't look, you know, quotation marks, normal. And, you know, but if we actually make the space and take the time to sit with people who may not interact or have a conversation like we're having right now, we may find out that there's like magic, you know, in that person.
What do you hope that people take away from Molly's room, or do take away, or that right now are home right now and probably thinking about, you know?
Well, you know, it's when we did our film, we found out that there were not hundreds, but thousands of families very similar to ours that had lost a family member, had been sent to an institution. So in that part of it, during our filmmaking, we also ended up going to Salem and getting a bill sponsored by Senator Peter Courtney, the president of the Senate at the time. And it was called Molly's Bill. And it was basically a bill to create a system where if you knew you had an aunt or an uncle or a family member that had been sent to an institution, but you didn't know where they were or how to get a hold of them and you wanted to, we did this Find Family Registry. It was a group we put together where people could send in information about a family member that might have been sent to an institution. The institution then would put the families together. They would set up a procedure and a process where they could reunite. It was quite exciting for us. We ended up having over 150 families reunite with a member that, as far as everybody knew, was gone and never be part of their lives again. But through this Find Family Registry, which unfortunately does no longer exist because of funding and all the other issues we have, but it helped put families back together. And today, a lot of those families are still together with family members that moved back in with them and fulfill their lives.
Well, last question now, because we're getting down to the wire here. When you think about it, there's probably hundreds of families out there right now that are probably wondering, or children of their parents, let's say in the 1950s, mm-hmm. probably wondering what I can do right now or what should I do? What could they do right now?
I don't know. That's a tough one. A lot of our people that we had in institutions are now at the age where they're not with us anymore, right? It's just a matter of that. So there's less and less of that. Mm-hmm. Although there's still talk about wanting to rejuvenate institutions and get them going again. It's just the wrong way to have lifestyles for us to live, so that institutional life. But it's something people need to understand, that people are different. And we need to learn to adapt to that. How do we work with them instead of against them? How do we bring them into our lives? How do we get them into our family rather than sending them away?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that, Darnell?
Well, absolutely. And I think, again, Bruce and Jill, the artist that conceived Our Fair View, Bruce is an artist, and he also is the director of Living Studios, which is a neurodivergent art group in Corvallis that works with neurodivergent population and gives them space to create their own artwork, and then gives them places to actually show their work. And in doing so, again, I feel like we're not only making space, but we're actually, giving people who maybe don't come in contact with neurodivergent people every day a place to basically learn about different perspectives, see what they're able to do and create, and hopefully we won't ever go back to this idea of putting people back into facilities or back into these terrible warehouses. We need to figure out more ways to incorporate.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you both for coming in today, Darnell Troen and Jeff Daly. And I want to thank my listeners for listening in today, and thank you very much. We'll see you next month. Bye.